English Radio. Coming up is the news.
That lines, Iran slams the U.S. government for its move to seize 36 websites belonging to Iranian and regional news networks, including Press TV. Media reports say four members of the death squad that murdered Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi have been trained in the United States. And Israeli settlers and forces attack Palestinian residents in a neighborhood in East Jerusalem on Al-Quds. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: Iran has condemned the U.S. for seizing 36 websites belonging to Iranian and regional news outlets, including Press TV. The Iranian president's chief of staff, Mahmoud Bouazizi, denounced Washington's measure as he spoke with reporters. Iran's permanent mission to the U.N. also called the measure illegal, pledging to follow it up through legal means. The seizure targets three websites linked to Iraq's Popular Mobilization Unit, as well as websites of Iran's Al-Alam and Yemen's Al-Masira TV channels, among others. Viewers trying to access the websites see a message showing the domains are seized by the U.S. government. The statement cites U.S. sanctions laws for the seizure. Press TV has announced that its website will be available on the .ir domain. For further insight on that story, we're joined by Professor of Management at University of Shizuoka, Mr. Seijiro Takeshita. Sir, welcome to the program. What do you make of this recent move by the U.S. government?
Well, I think you have to look into a one step deeper, and that is that it's not Iran versus the United States. It has to do with the hegemony of fight between the United States and China. And unfortunately, Iran has come a lot closer to China, and obviously, United States and, along with the United States, a lot of free world is now trying to cut off China from its, for example, distribution base, because they're trying to really utilize their power to strengthen their influence. So, this is a very unfortunate situation, I believe, because what Iran should have done and could have done is that they shouldn't side favorably with China, but regain its relationship with Europe and also with the United States, especially now that it's not President Trump anymore, but it's President Biden.
Mr. Takeshita, talking about the legal channels to follow up on this, give us your thoughts on where that process could end, and should we be seeing more intervention from the likes of international bodies, maybe the United Nations, when a country, in this case the United States, does such actions unilaterally?
I think what we really need to see is a third-party litigation party that comes in. Absolutely, as you suggested, it could be UN or it could be some European nation which has a very strong tie with Iran, for example, like France or Germany. Which also has a lot of benefits and future benefits with Iran and the economic ties that are likely to come through. We really need to hold an alliance, not separate, such actions which could induce people to move further away from our regime is really not favorable. But I think what you have to understand here is the real reason for the United States taking such action is more to do with hegemony of fight with China. So what we really need to see is a much more bridge that needs to be built with Iran and the Western Hemisphere.
But yeah, the bridge is one thing. Apart from that, it's the fact that is what the United States doing legal or not?
Well, I think we have to wait and see for the third-party litigation party to come in, because there are lots of opinion which basically suggests that could possibly justify at least partly the action of the United States. But again, the time is quite crucial at this point, especially when all the countries are trying to redo or rejuvenate their distribution bases, especially on just-in-case basis from just-in-time. And the important thing here is that they're trying to cut off China from their excessive reliance. And if Iran cannot comply with the world demand or the free world demand, then I think it's going to move further away from regaining economic prosperity, which they could have had with the Europeans, especially when Mr. Trump came in power.
All right, thanks a lot. Seijiro Takeshita joining us from Shizuoka. Elsewhere, four of the Saudi operatives who participated in the 2018 killing of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi had received paramilitary training in the U.S. That's what a leading American daily says, according to the New York Times. U.S. State Department approved the training. It was provided by a private security company. In the state of Arkansas, the firm had previously confirmed its role in the training of the several members of the Khashoggi kill team. The State Department says it cannot legally comment on what it has referred to as licensed defense export activities. Khashoggi was killed in the Turkish city of Istanbul on October the 2nd, 2018, after he entered the Saudi consulate there. U.S. intelligence reports have said Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman approved the murder. Well, this just in, according to security sources, a sabotage attempt on the building of an atomic energy organization of Iran has been foiled. These are the latest details that we're getting for you, and we'll keep you posted as we get more information right here on Press TV. Elsewhere, Israeli forces have demolished more Palestinian structures in the occupied West Bank. Palestinian media say loaders accompanied by troops flattened buildings near the outpost of Benyamin. Last week, Israeli forces also leveled a house in the town of Beit Omar. The cases are the latest in Israel's long-running campaign of demolishing Palestinian homes and properties. The structures are destroyed, usually under the pretext that they lack construction permits. The Palestinians say the demolitions are part of efforts by Israel to expand its settlements in the occupied territories. The regime has been expanding settler units in defiance of international law. Israeli settlers forces have attacked Palestinian residents in the occupied East Jerusalem Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. Two Palestinians have been arrested as regime forces raided Palestinian homes since May. The Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood has become the focal point of tensions after the regime handed out eviction orders to several Palestinian families there. Clashes ensued with Israeli forces using heavy-handed tactics against Palestinian protesters in the occupied territories. Three Palestinian prisoners remain on hunger strike in an Israeli jail to protest their illegal detention without charge or trial under the so-called administrative detention. One of the hunger strikers has been transferred to hospital, but he insists to continue his strike until Israel releases him. Mona Kandil reports from Ramallah.
A number of Palestinian prisoners are going on with an open-ended hunger strike to protest their illegal imprisonment without charge or trial under Israel's so-called administrative detention. At least three prisoners insist to continue their strike despite their seriously deteriorating condition until Israel releases them. Among them is 28-year-old Ghadanfar Abu Atwan, who has started his hunger strike almost 50 days ago. After starting his strike, Israel's prison authorities placed him in isolation. Later, he was transferred to Kaplan Medical Center south of Tel Aviv because of his serious illness, and he's being held there under detention.
Of course, when all doors are shut down in the face of the prisoners to get rid of the administrative detention, they have few means to protest and they have to engage in the hunger strike battle, especially that many prisoners' terms are renewed for several times and this without charge or trial. When Ghadanfar started his protest, he was beaten and tortured by the Israeli jailers and he was held in solitary confinement.
Palestinians held a protest in solidarity with the prisoners outside the Red Cross Committee building in Ramallah. The oldest of those taking part is 59-year-old, a senior leader of the Hamas movement, Jamal al-Tawil, joined in protest over the detention of his daughter, journalist Bushra al-Tawil. He's demanding Israeli authorities to release him and his daughter. Israeli court had extended Bushra's previous administrative detention order last March. There is also Sheikh Khadr Adnan, prominent leader of the jihad movement, whom is staging his fifth hunger strike. This is the 12th time he has been detained.
Today we are here not only to stand by the prisoners and support them. This is the least we can do against the administrative detention policy. Israel arrests people from all walks of life and different political spectrum. We are in real need to launch a national and worldwide campaign to force Israel to stop this policy that exposes the Israeli authorities and their illegal practices.
The Palestinian Prisoners Society said the Israeli authorities have lately increased the use of administrative detention against Palestinians. The committee said Israeli authorities issued 200 administrative detention orders since the beginning of May. The majority of the hunger-striking prisoners are those who are held arbitrarily under Israel's policy of administrative detention. That's why they put their lives on the line to demand not only their freedom, but an end to the administrative detention policy. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Yemen has slammed as disgraceful the UN chief's decision to add Ansar al-Movement to a blacklist of groups for violating children's rights. Yemeni protesters, including children, have turned out en masse to condemn the UN move. They say the UN must instead turn its attention to addressing the Saudi blockade and attacks that have taken a heavy toll on Yemeni civilians.
The United Nations has blacklisted Yemen's Ansar al-Law, accusing it of violating children's rights. The move has drawn Yemen's ire. Yemen's political leadership has blamed the world body for its apathy towards the continued Saudi violations against the children of Yemen. Yemeni officials say the UN should play its role to lift the Saudi blockade on Yemenis that's killing children instead of blacklisting the Ansar al-Law movement. Member of the Supreme Political Council, Mohammed al-Houthi, dismissed as baseless the UN accusation, saying it did not refer to an investigation on the ground as the movement had demanded. Meanwhile, Yemen's Minister of Information said the UN had turned a blind eye to the ongoing Saudi blockade and attacks on Yemenis, which have led to the death of tens of Yemeni children on a daily basis.
I think it's a political decision by the part of the United Nations. They're being faced with pressure from the United States, Britain, and France, who are making billions of dollars selling arms to Saudi Arabia and to the United Arab Emirates. And in addition, I think it may have been part of a concession for the re-election of the current Secretary General for the United Nations, who just was re-elected. So it's clearly political, it's not fair, and I guess it points to the fact that the United Nations is losing its utility and is becoming sort of a pawn in the part of the Western powers, in particular the United States.
Observers say the United Nations blacklisting of Ansar al-Law has no relation to the humanitarian situation in Yemen. They believe that the UN must take real action against the Saudi blockade if it has real intentions to end the suffering of millions of Yemenis.
According to Yemen's health ministry, 80,000 people requiring urgent medical care abroad have died due to the Saudi blockade. The ministry data also suggests that every 5 minutes a Yemeni child dies due to poverty and lack of access to proper medical equipment, all resulting from the Saudi blockade. And why has the UN blacklisted Yemen and not the Saudi-led coalition for violating children's rights?
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015. The war has killed thousands of civilians, including women and children. Yemen is now dealing with what the United Nations has called the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The UN added the Saudi-led coalition to its blacklist of violators of children's rights in 2016, a move that was soon reversed by former UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. Ban Ki-moon said he delisted the coalition after he faced pressure from a number of Saudi Arabia's allies that threatened to cut crucial funding to many UN programs.
This was one of the most painful and difficult decisions I have had to make. The report describes horrors no child should have to face. At the same time, I also had to consider the very real prospect that millions of other children would suffer grievously if, as was suggested to me, countries would defund many UN programs.
The move drew angry reactions from human rights activists who said the UN Secretary General's office had hit a new low. Last year, the UN removed the coalition from its blacklist, citing a decline in the number of those killed and maimed in Yemen.
I would say that the Saudis and some of their rich allies would be threatening the United Nations to withdraw funding. Under Donald Trump, they did withdraw funding for the UN, and Biden has restored it, but I suspect that there was some hidden agenda on it that they still want to support Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and don't like the fact that the Ansar movement and the Shias in Yemen like to be independent and not be dictated to by the Saudis and indirectly by the United States and its allies.
The Saudi-led coalition's blockade and its war on Yemen continue to claim millions of innocent lives. The United Nations has a responsibility to help end people suffering. Taking a one-sided approach to conflicts will never resolve them.
Moving on, China has accused the U.S. of creating trouble in the Taiwan Strait after an American warship sailed through the sensitive waterway that separates Taiwan from China. China said the U.S. is intentionally playing the same old tricks and disrupting things in the Taiwan Strait. Beijing described Washington as the greatest security risk creator in the region. The U.S. Navy has confirmed the transit. It said the Tuesday sailing was a routine mission in accordance with international law. The U.S. has stepped up such missions in the past months despite China's opposition. China considers Taiwan its own territory. It believes the American missions send a message of support to Taiwan that seeks independence. The Pentagon's top brass has voiced concern over legislation that would overhaul the U.S. military justice system. For crimes like sexual assault, the legislation removes decisions about prosecuting sexual assault and other major crimes from the military chain of command. The bill turns such decisions over to trained prosecutors. Now opponents say they acknowledge failings in the current process of addressing those issues. But they reject the bill for various reasons. Some say it's too broad. Others cast doubt over the timeline for its implementation. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has backed overhauling the military justice system that has recently come under scrutiny. Last December, more than a dozen commanders and unit leaders were sacked over a series of murders and sex crimes at a major U.S. military base. A human rights group says that thousands of migrants stranded in Mexico due to a U.S. border policy have been kidnapped, raped, trafficked, or assaulted. This is according to Human Rights First, a New York-based group that documents cases of migrants and asylum seekers stuck in Mexico since President Joe Biden took office in January. It says the number of cases has recently hiked from some 500 such incidents logged in April to 3,300 by mid-June. During Biden's five-month tenure, more than 400,000 migrants detained at or near the border have been expelled. The Biden administration argues the move is aimed at limiting the spread of the coronavirus despite opposition from health experts. Well, that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish. While the Biden administration vowed to end Trump's practice of expelling unaccompanied minors, the practice persists for children from Mexico. Dear listeners, please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Ryan Devereux Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Biden administration is routinely sending Mexican children back to danger, report finds. Here's more. The Biden administration is presiding over the systematic and illegal removal of unaccompanied Mexican children seeking asylum at the border, according to a new report, with thousands of vulnerable young people returned to a country that has experienced staggering levels of violence in recent years. The report published by Amnesty International recently comes just days after Vice President Kamala Harris, in her first foreign trip since entering office, visited Guatemala and Mexico, where she told would-be migrants and asylum seekers not to come to the U.S. and that they would be turned back if they did. As legal experts and immigrant rights advocates were quick to point out, seeking asylum is a right protected under international and domestic law. According to interviews and data obtained by Amnesty, the U.S. and Mexico have engaged in the systematic violation of those laws in their treatment of unaccompanied Mexican children, 95% of whom were returned to Mexico over a six-month period, often without a screening to determine whether they face threats in their home country. Brian Griffey, the author and lead researcher on the report, said that when his team began working on the project in early 2020, the plan was not to focus on unaccompanied Mexican children. One of the things that surprised us when we were down there speaking with Mexican authorities was to find out that the vast majority of unaccompanied kids that they were processing in shelters and such were actually Mexican kids being returned by the U.S., Griffey told The Intercept. This is clearly a protection gap through which the U.S. Border Patrol is pushing tens of thousands of unaccompanied Mexican kids back potentially into harm's way. In Ciudad Juarez, the sprawling border city opposite El Paso, Texas, Customs and Border Protection returned 750 unaccompanied Mexican children from January to May of this year. This compared to 744 in all of 2020 and 1,283 in all of 2019. The Amnesty report said Juarez was experiencing nearly 100 murders a day during that same period, with May marking the deadliest month of the year in the city. Shelter managers in Juarez told Amnesty researchers that they had reported to putting some of the children returned by the U.S. into hiding, given the threats they faced in Mexico. Many border cities in the north of the country, the localities where the U.S. removes people to an regular basis, are among the most dangerous, particularly for migrants and asylum seekers who are often targets of extortion and kidnapping. One in every three migrants and asylum seekers from Central America and Mexico is a child, and half of them are unaccompanied by family members or other adults. Amnesty noted in its report, adding that Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas has said that more than 80% of those children have family members waiting to receive them in the U.S. The fact that almost none of the tens of thousands of unaccompanied children being processed by the Office of Refugee Resettlement, or ORR have been Mexican nationals showcases the Biden administration's failed promise not to turn away unaccompanied migrant children to the same threats of harm that they fled, the report said, referring to the Department of Health and Human Services office responsible for unaccompanied children who cross the border. Since March 2020, the U.S. has enforced Title 42, a Centers for Disease Control and Prevention rule pushed through by Stephen Miller, Donald Trump's hardline anti-immigrant advisor, with the onset of the coronavirus. Under the rule, border authorities have assumed the power to rapidly expel individuals encountered between ports of entry and the borderlands without any semblance of due process or a hearing, and regardless of whether they're exercising their right under domestic and international law. More than 867,000 expulsions and counting have been carried out since the rule went into effect, raising the possibility that the Biden administration could preside over the millionth expulsion to result from the most sweeping border enforcement initiative of the Trump era. Unlike the Trump administration, which booted at least 13,000 children back across the border under Title 42, the Biden administration has largely stopped using Title 42 to expel most unaccompanied children. Yet Amnesty found that Mexican children seeking asylum are facing a different reality, with border officials using a separate law, one ostensibly designed to protect vulnerable youth, to systematically remove unaccompanied Mexican children from the U.S. The administration does not deny the policy. On the contrary, in an interview with an El Paso television station last month, President Joe Biden Assistant White House Press Secretary and Immigration Advisor Vidant Patel said, "The policy right now for the Mexican unaccompanied minors is for them to be repatriated through that process." As Amnesty noted, the policy was further confirmed in a joint HHS-DHS report documenting the number of unaccompanied youth in government custody. In a footnote, the document said this number does not include children from Mexico, most of whom will be repatriated and will not remain in CBP custody. From November through April, roughly 1 in 5 of all unaccompanied children apprehended by the Border Patrol were Mexican. In May, CBP informed Amnesty that it had returned more than 10,000 of those children to Mexico, while referring only a few hundred to ORR. In total, unaccompanied Mexican children were returned to Mexico more than 22 times as often as they were transferred to ORR after being apprehended by U.S. Border Patrol, Amnesty found. Unaccompanied Mexican children were therefore returned to Mexico in approximately 95% of cases after being apprehended by U.S. Border Patrol. The report added that the systematic forced returns of Mexican children by U.S. authorities often happened without the legally required screenings of the children for fear of return to Mexico, which are supposed to ensure they are not being returned to harm or are victims of human trafficking. Amnesty says that border authorities are misusing a provision in the Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act that applies only to Mexican and Canadian children and prohibits the U.S. from sending them to dangerous conditions.
the debate.
Hello and welcome to another edition of The Debate. Thousands gathered in London to call on G7 leaders to end their support for the Israeli regime. They demanded an end to what they called complicity in Israel's war crimes against Palestinians. In this edition of The Debate, we will scrutinize the role that developed countries are playing in the ongoing suffering of Palestinians and the pro-Palestinian protesters' demands.
As the G7 descended on Cornwall for the summit, thousands of passionate pro-Palestine protesters amassed outside Downing Street in central London on Saturday to vent their anger over ongoing Israeli crimes against the Palestinians.
These protesters are absolutely furious at the lack of action from world leaders following Israel's recent and relentless attacks on Gaza and the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Although a ceasefire has been agreed since then, the fact that Palestinians are still forced to live under an apartheid regime has bitterly fueled the anger of these protesters who want to force a change.
Protesters had various demands, including international recognition of the Palestinian state and an end to Israeli arms sales.
If arms are used in violation of international law, they must be banned, embargoed immediately. Also, the issue of settlement products, they must be banned immediately. Those are illegal products. The recognition of the state of Palestine is long overdue. We do not understand why the UK government is not even listening to the voices of its own people, the voices of its own parliament that voted overwhelmingly to recognize the state of Palestine. The lack of recognition is not only immoral, it is undemocratic.
Place an embargo on Israel. Stop the arms deal. So this is the message that we're sending to the people who are with us. We're in our thousands, and we are going to continue until, honestly, the Palestinians are free and occupation is ended.
We are not going to forget the mark of shame upon the history of this country that brought us to where we are today, the Balfour Declaration. We demand a public apology from the British government, as well as recognition of our state of Palestine. On top of that, we want sanctions now. We want justice. We want action.
The bombs may have temporarily stopped falling, but while Israel's systematic discrimination against the Palestinian people continues, so will the protests. Robert Carter, London.
Now, to discuss that further, we're joined by Youssef Al-Halou, Palestinian journalist and political analyst, who is joining us from London, and also Mr. William Morris from the Next Century Foundation, the Secretary General, of course. Thank you very much for joining us, both of you. Let's begin with Youssef Al-Halou now. Labour lawmaker and former party leader Jeremy Corbyn addressed the crowd and stressed that industrial powers should end human rights abuses. What exactly did he mean by that?
Well, thank you for having me. Let's just assert that despite the fact that the ceasefire is still holding, it is fragile, that ceasefire did not end Israel's military occupation. And to put things into context, the Palestinian cause is gaining momentum. We saw those demonstrators in the British capital demanding the British government to impose embargo or stop arming Israel. Now, Jeremy Corbyn and other political figures, of course, they know clearly that Israel is enjoying a culture of impunity. When it comes to interests, we know that many countries around the world take Israel as a strategic ally. So we are not expecting the G7 leaders to really denounce Israel because obviously Israel is as a proxy for those nations in the Middle East. And also, let me just remind the viewers that even the Palestinian mission in London, Mr. Hussam Zomer, who just spoke in the report, he said that he believes that the UK believes that Israel is violating international law. So such statements from Corbyn or other officials, of course, reflects the hypocrisy of the international community when it comes to the Palestinian rights. Palestinians are being dealt with as subhumans, are being demonized because simply they are resisting the Israeli occupation.
Thank you very much. Let's bring in Mr. William Morris. In what ways do you believe that the G7 leaders are considered complicit in Israel's war crimes?
I don't even believe you're on the same planet as I am. I don't call them war crimes. I mean, unless you're talking about many governments in the Middle East having committed war crimes. No, I mean, the G7 leaders met to consider China, climate change, and COVID. Israel was not on their agenda. But the Palestinian
Of course, Mr. Morris, this was what the protesters were demanding. We're talking about the protests outside the summit, not what was happening inside the meeting.
Okay, well, there were big issues that occupied their time that they met to discuss. Now, Israel and Palestine has actually is back on the agenda internationally in a major way, and this is actually a consequence of this little war that's gone on. So there is a real opportunity for Middle East peace, and if nations in the region, including Iran, and nations internationally, including the United States of America, tried to really support moves towards a Middle East peace, we might get somewhere this time around. It's very encouraging that we have a new government in Israel. I mean, it's not the kind of government that is perfection, not by a mile, but it's a bit of fresh air. So we have an opportunity. We have an opportunity to build a peace instead of ongoing hatred, and that is an opportunity that should not be lost at this moment.
So, Mr. Morris, how do you believe peace can be achieved as long as Israel is not respecting international law and its international obligations? I'm referring to the settlement buildings in particular.
International law has never been respected by anybody unless it's convenient to the great powers, Russia or America or whoever. I mean, you know, under international law, Jerusalem should be a state, as you know, a corpus separatum. It should be an international city. International law is utterly meaningless, but what matters is what people care about and what can be done to make for fair play and a way forward. And there's a real opportunity for peace now. It's interesting, Biden, who is a Zionist, but then all of us in the West are Zionists because we all believe in an Israeli state.
Let's bring in Mr. Yusuf Al-Halou.
Who cares about the future?
Thank you very much, Mr. Morris. Let's bring in Yusuf Al-Halou. Now, Mr. Halou, what do you have to say in response to Mr. Morris? He says that, first of all, there were no war crimes committed there, not more than anywhere else in the world, and also international law is not respected by anyone, and that's a good excuse for Israel not to respect international law as well.
Well, even Israeli figures, they say that Israel is an apartheid state. Israel is even worse than apartheid state. And we know that Israel is annoyed from the BDS campaign. That's why it has allocated millions of pounds or dollars to combat those activists who are calling for disarming Israel or sanctioning Israel. Ironically, Israel is being viewed as the only democracy in the Middle East. And Israel is allowed to arm itself to the teeth with military equipment from the United States. And Israel has been using Gaza as a testing ground for its weapons. So Israel is a strategic ally, as I said, to those nations, because obviously there is intelligence collaboration, and Israel is dominating the Western agenda when it comes to self-defense, as if Israel is only allowed to defend itself from those Palestinian, homemade rockets or resistance activities, whereas Palestinians who have been subjected to military brutal occupation since 1948, they have no right whatsoever to defend themselves. So obviously crimes were committed, atrocities, ethnic cleansing is still ongoing since 1948. So obviously everybody knows that Israel has violated numerous UN resolutions. Israel considers itself above the international law. It's a rogue state. It has never respected any regulation or convention or international UN Security Council resolution.
Mr. Al-Halou, Mr. Morris believes that now with a new Israeli government, of course that is if they win the vote of confidence from the Knesset, with a new Israeli government, there will be hope for peace. How optimistic are you?
We are not optimistic at all because we know that the Israeli government or Israeli successive governments, they use Palestinian blood as a winning card. You know, we know the settlers, they are allowed to behave in this provocative manners, attacking Palestinians, confiscating Palestinian lands in Sheikh Jarrah or elsewhere. So we do not pin high hopes on any government because we know from previous experiences that Israel is not interested in peace, and this is crystal clear.
Thank you very much. Mr. Morris, you heard Ms. Al-Halu. He says that Israel is basically not interested in peace, and the settlement buildings also confirm that. So why do you think a new government in Israel, which of course we do know the right wing still has the most power, and those are the ones that insist on the settlement buildings, why do you think there's room for peace?
Much of your rhetoric, and I'm sorry, it's based on hatred. And if you go on about apartheid state and hate, you're not going to build a climate for peace. And if you are no hopers that regard the situation as being hopeless, then you may as well crawl into a hole and forget it. I mean, people have to work for peace. And there is a real need, both on the Palestinian side as well as on the Israeli side, for new government and for a new approach. Abu Mazen is really has lost the plot. I mean, he scarcely has any credibility. Hamas say they won't. It's very convenient for them that they don't have to negotiate with Israel because they can say Israel won't negotiate with them. It's all very childish. But we have a situation in which the Palestinians have given Israel a wake-up call, and nobody can take the Palestinians for granted anymore. So it is time and opportunity to build peace now, and to build on this current situation, and to find a better way forward. And the international powers can help in this, and not just the United States of America, but Russia, Britain, and the others. And I think there is a mood, a genuine mood, to do something. It does require help from the Palestinians, and it requires help from countries like Iran. I mean, Iran arguably provided weapons to Gaza. I don't know. You know better than I would. But so, I mean, Iran is a player in this game. I don't think we'd have peace in the Middle East unless Iran is interested in helping build peace in the Middle East. But it's an opportunity.
Well, Iran's position has always been very clear, Mr. Morris. They want what the people of Palestine want. Iran has always been a supporter of Palestinian people, and Iran has always called for a referendum to decide what should happen in Israel. Now, let's go back to our topic, which was the protest. Mr. Morris, what was the demands of this Resist G7 coalition? What were they trying to achieve, and do you believe that they got close to their goals or not?
I think it's important that there were protests because it does help raise, I mean, there are protests on many things, as you know, at this moment, not just on Israel and Palestine, but there are many, many protests around the G7 on a whole range of issues. The most predominant one was on climate change, but nonetheless, it does help having this kind of, this raised awareness of the situation in Israel and Palestine. And so protests matter. They matter hugely in the West. They make a great difference. As to the rhetoric we hear, I mean, much of it is pretty extreme and unhelpful. But that's not the point. The point is that the issue is back on the table. Peace is back on the table. We have an opportunity. And you refer to settlement building. One of Abu Mazen's sins has been to halt peace negotiations as long as settlement building continues. Makes a very easy excuse for people, right-wingers like Benjamin Netanyahu, who can rub his hands in glee. I mean, something Arafat would never have done. He can rub his hands in glee and sit back and say, okay, so they won't talk to us, so we won't talk to them. But fortunately, we have the chance of a new government in Israel. We just need the same in Palestine, and we might move forward.
Thank you very much. Mr. Al-Halu, what is your response to Mr. Morris? Do you believe that there is a chance for peace with a new government in Palestine?
Well, we Palestinians, we are peace-loving people. Well, we hope so. You know, there will always be hope. But we know that according to Oslo Accords, by the year 2000, Palestinians should have had their own Palestinian state, and Israel destroyed the Palestinian cause ever since the provocative visit of Sharon at the time in the year 2000. We are fed up from this occupation. Enough is enough. Netanyahu himself, he repeated many times saying that the land is too small to be shared. So it's obvious that Israel is not interested to have a Palestinian state not next to its. And by the way, let's just make it clear, Israel has no recognized border. Israel has no constitution. So what peace we are talking about, Gaza, West Bank, East Jerusalem, is less than 20% of historic Palestine. So even if this historic, if this viable Palestinian state was agreed to be established, then it will be demilitarized. I mean, Palestinians are really eager to see peace prevail in the Middle East. So, but unfortunately, that we are being let down. We don't have high hopes when it comes to assuring Palestinians, oh, you have to adopt the nonviolent resistance, the peaceful methods. We tried everything. And by the way, President Abbas is Israel's best Palestinian leader at the time, because obviously, it's not a hidden fact that the Palestinian Authority has made many concessions, whether it's during Arafat era or Abbas era. So any Palestinian leader, obviously, the Palestinian side is the weakest side. Let's disagree on that. Israel is the one who is dictating these rules because the Palestinian Authority is receiving the financial support from donor countries. So Palestinians, they have no sovereignty. So at the end of the day, Let's hope that the new government in Israel will strike deal with the Palestinians. But we don't have high hopes, to be honest.
Now, Mr. Al-Halu, Mr. Morris also mentioned that the voices of Palestinians are now being heard. Do you believe so?
I think the new generation is making a huge impact and effect. We saw the activists in Sheikh Jarrah. We saw new faces on the ground. The Palestinian cause is back to the forefront. What happened recently in those neighborhoods in Jerusalem or the aggression on Gaza has sent shockwaves. It's an awakening because the world also is fed up. The world is annoyed from the fact that Israel continues year after year, day after day with the occupation, atrocities, killing, imprisonment, confiscation of lands, and so on. The list is too long. So let's just put things into context. Israel can end the occupation now if it wants to, but it doesn't want that because it enjoys the control of other people, the Palestinians.
Thank you very much. Mr. Morris, now you heard what Mr. Al-Halu said. On the other hand, you seem to be very optimistic. So if you could please tell us about this demonstration, and you did also mention that their voices are heard and now they can make an impact. Do you believe that these G7 leaders will take any steps in order to get closer to the goal that you mentioned, peace?
Oh, 100%. I think it's a priority for Biden, less so perhaps for the others. But Biden has sort of begun to indicate that he really does care about this issue. Now, I did say he was a Zionist, but he has done some interesting little things. He's reopened the U.S., well, what was it, a consulate, but basically the U.S. offices in East Jerusalem, which haven't been there for, what, 20 years, 30 years? I mean, I can't remember them being open. So he's beginning to make a kind of a move. And I'm very encouraged. I think that there is a care about the man. He does care about the Israel-Palestine situation. And he wants a viable Israeli state as well as a viable Palestinian state. He's a two-state man, whatever his sins. So, you know, I think, and he'd be better with regard to Iran. Compared to Donald Trump, he's a breath of fresh air. I would like to see a new leader on the Palestinian side, someone like Marwan Barghouti, who could actually negotiate peace but isn't actually asleep all the time. But That said, it is an opportunity, and we do have a chance for a better tomorrow. Now.
So, Mr. Morris, protesters were also predominantly talking about BDS, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, to force Israel to respect Palestinian rights. Do you think this has played a role in pushing Israel towards moving towards peace?
You're an Iranian, and you support sanctions. You know what they've done to Iran. Sanctions are always wrong. Always wrong. I mean, okay, arguably against apartheid South Africa. But they've, since that day, they've never been effective. All they've done is punished ordinary people, punished ordinary Iranians or ordinary Syrians. Look at Syria under sanctions. I mean, you know, it's and the BDS, I mean, boycott. Well, fortunately, in my view, it's not made that much of an impression. But what has made an impression is these protests. They do matter. And if you want, the biggest thing in the United Kingdom, where I'm living, has been the Balfour Initiative. I don't know whether you've come across it, but that was very powerful, an activist campaign for a Palestinian state, which was very respected and brought Corbyn on board and his team. So, I mean, we have an opportunity. Actually, there is a Palestinian state. There is a Palestinian state. Let's just make this clear. And the campaign for greater recognition is an important one, as Mr. Halou mentioned. It's a very important one. It's gaining momentum, and I think that matters a great deal.
So, Mr. Al-Halou, what is your opinion regarding the BDS movement?
Well, solidarity is as important as the BDS campaign. Well, this is what Palestinians are adopting. They say that the BDS is effective, and this can be seen from Israel's reaction by fighting those activists worldwide, by classifying those BDS activists as anti-Semite. We know that Israel is also annoyed from the growing solidarity when it comes to celebrities. We've seen the angry reaction from Israeli officials towards those celebrities, you know, Ms. Hadid and the other ones. So this is what the Palestinians are left with. You know, Palestinians have tried everything. And they hope that by following the footsteps of the South African experience, this might mount pressure on Israel. What they can do. Israel has got, you know, the powerful army in the region, whereas Palestinians, when they throw stones, they are described as terrorists. So we have a double standard policy here. Palestinians, they will try everything possible on the table just to make their voices heard.
Thank you very much, Mr. Youssef Al-Halou, Palestinian journalist and political analyst, joining us from London, and also Mr. William Morris, the Next Century Foundation Secretary General. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for joining us on this edition of The Debate.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and scholar Allama Baqir Sharif al-Qurashi. This great Muslim scholar and historian was born in 1344 AH in the city of Najaf. He's well known for his books on the biography and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Please stay with me. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, peace be upon him, said, "Assume the truth. Leave that which does not concern you. Avoid your enemy. Be careful of your friends, except the trusty ones who fear Allah. Do not make friends with the sinner. Do not inform him of your secrets. Ask the advice of those who fear Allah."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Imam Baqir alayhi salam urged his companions on many different occasions that people should treat other people according to the rules of social conduct, these rules that Islam has prescribed for the perfection and the harmony of humanity and of human beings. When Imam al-Baqir was speaking with one of his close companions by the name of Jabir al-Ju'fi, we find that Imam al-Baqir, when speaking about these social etiquettes prescribed by Islam, he tells Jabir al-Ju'fi that a man should be loyal to his brother as he is loyal to himself. It's a very beautiful statement here in this conversation between the master and the student, the teacher and the student, where we learn that a human being, a person, should be loyal to their brother as they are loyal to themselves. Now, this isn't talking about a blood brother specifically or limited to a blood brother. This is talking about our brothers in faith, our brothers in iman, our brothers in Islam, who say, La ilaha illallah, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad al-Rasulullah, and Muhammad is the messenger of Allah. These are our brothers. Now, we should be loyal to them as we are loyal to ourselves. For example, we wouldn't cheat ourselves, we wouldn't lie to ourselves, we wouldn't backbite ourselves, we wouldn't deceive ourselves, we wouldn't want to hurt ourselves physically or spiritually. And likewise, we cannot do any of these things with our brother. A very beautiful statement here from Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam when talking to his companion Jabir al-Jufi, a human being should be loyal to their brother.